Welcome back to the Mystical Positivist. I'm your host, Stuart Goodnick. Joining me is co-host Rob Schmidt. This week on the show, we feature an in-studio conversation with Joshua Levitt. Joshua Levitt has pursued spiritual practice intensely since the late 1980s, including extensive stays in Israel and India, living for 5 years on an ashram in the U.S., and working closely with spiritual teachers from the Baal tradition, which originated in Bengal, India. Well, since during the break we were listening to a piece, a Baal piece, and it's a tradition that I don't think has a lot of familiarity for most people in the West. So Right. Maybe we should start there in this second hour about your relationship with the Baal tradition and the work you're doing now, and tell us a little bit about the background of the tradition.
So the piece we just heard was a piece by Sanatan Das Thakur Baul, who I had the good fortune to meet through the sort of the grace and generosity of one of the teachers in my lineage, Lee Lozowick. And I was, I don't know, maybe 22 or something, and had gone to Arizona to study with Lee as a teacher, a spiritual teacher, and I was living there. I'd moved there. I was living there for about a year and a half, and I'd been there for maybe a couple of months. And this Baul, Bengali Baul, and his two sons showed up wearing their traditional Baul dress with patchwork robes and turbans, and singing these absolutely exquisite and extraordinary songs. And they were there at the ashram for about 3 months. They traveled around during that time, but there was a fair amount of time that they were just living there in a little trailer. And so that was, I think, within the first 6 months of my encountering this kind of experimental American spiritual community that had this Baal connection and trying to sort it all out. Lee and his community formed this very strong connection with Sanatan on that visit, and over the years kept that connection alive. And eventually Sanatan found a lineage holder, Parvati Baul, and so Lee and members of his community met Parvati in, I think, 2008 in Kolkata, India. And so there's been this kind of a couple of generations now of these connections between these Western Baals, who are very eclectic and kind of weird and funky and drawing from all these different spiritual traditions, and just sort of, you know, Lee declared himself to be a Baal. And you know, that's a kind of an absolutely outrageous thing to do.
It was ballsy, if nothing else.
Of course, right, if nothing else. But, I mean, it's just like... But the funny thing about it is that it was also a very Baal kind of a thing to do. Hmm. And so when Sanatan came in 1991 or maybe 92, he sort of took a look around and he looked at Lee and he called Lee a Baal guru, and that was sort of as close to a stamp of approval from the Baal tradition as you're going to get, which the Baal tradition, one of the interesting things about it is there is no formal hierarchy whatsoever. Mm-hmm. There is no Baal pope, or there is no Baal, what's the term they have for these, like in the yoga, the more traditional yoga traditions in India, they're Shankaracharyas, right? So there's all kinds of informal hierarchy, of course, because that you can't ever not have hierarchy. But that's about as close as a stamp of approval as you can get. As that has kind of unfolded and continued, again, through the generosity and grace of other teachers in that lineage, Porna Steinitz and Lalita Thomas, I was able to spend some time with Parvati a few years ago in India. And it just happened to be a time when she was had received some requests to perform in the U.S., and I was able to help sort of organize that. And so there's now a collection of a network of people across the U.S. and quite a few here in the Bay Area who are devoted to bringing her to the U.S., supporting her efforts to create an ashram and a school in India, And in that process, getting to have the sweetness of good company of friends who are inspired by a shared purpose.
So what is the, you know, beyond the musical tradition which we were listening to?
Yeah.
I mean, what distinguishes the bowel tradition? And I'm just, you know, besides declaring oneself one, yeah. Is there a practicum? Is there a tradition? You know, so
absolutely. So there's a few very interesting distinctive things about the bowel tradition. It's simultaneously a creative and artistic tradition of folk music, and a spiritual tradition of very rigorous and specific internal and external yogic practices. And it's a fascinating, and in my knowledge, it's a pretty unique fusion of those two. It has a third component, which is as a sort of a social movement. My understanding is that the bowel tradition originated amongst very, very poor rural people in Bengal, many of whom were not even literate originally. And from the very earliest stages of the bowel path as a distinct tradition in India, it was very kind of subversive of traditional hierarchies. The bowels, to this day, and as far as I know, have always rejected the caste system entirely and completely. They are outspoken in denouncing it and saying it has no reality. Not only that, they actually don't tend to not acknowledge the validity of the distinction between the Muslim and Hindu traditions in India, or at least they don't pay attention to those distinctions very much.
That's pretty radical in India.
Very radical. There's been, you know, centuries of conflict and bloodshed and terrible suffering related to those different traditions.
Continuing to today,
very much so. And so the Bowls have taken this radical stance from a very early period. And so today in India, you will find Bowls who by family and kind of personal tradition have a Hindu background, and their bowel songs reflect that. Mm-hmm. And then you have bowels who are called fakirs, who tend to come from an Islamic family or traditional background, and their songs have the reflection of that, but they all consider themselves bowels first and foremost. Their bowels intermarry across caste lines, across religion lines, so they do all of these things that in traditional Indian society are very radical and controversial and sort of subversive. So there are academics who've been fascinated with the bowel tradition, not because they were oriented towards spiritual practice, but because it was an example of this sort of peasant folk tradition, social movement that was embodied a very strong critique of traditional, you know, power structures and all those kinds of things, and that's why they were interested in the bowel tradition.
Yeah. So one further question about the bowels then would be, how does this non-formal hierarchical people coming from all different places in Indian, or you know, the society of the Indian subcontinent.
Right.
How does that manifest as community compared with, say, the sorts of communities we were talking about in the first hour?
I don't think that I have the range of experience in India to be able to answer that question.
Okay.
But I can speak from personal experience. One of the things that has been interesting to me in these past few years, and working closely with Parvati when she's here in the U.S. and observing how she conducts her business as a traditional bowel performer and guru and as a lineage holder, but has been to notice sort of the similarities and the differences between the training that I got in my communities. And one thing I notice in her case is that her guru, Shanatan Baba, who we were just listening to a moment ago, from what I understand was a very renowned Bowell, both as a performer and as a spiritual teacher. He was, you know, there's always politics and gossip, and, you know, these people don't like those people and so on, but he seemed to have been one of the people that nobody could really argue that he was the real thing, right? So he was an eminent person in the Bowell tradition, considering the fact that there's no formal hierarchy.
Right.
And he, in my understanding, lived in a very remote, small ashram. Parvati had a very traditional discipleship with him. She spent 7 years living with him in his home, learning one song per year for 7 years. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting distinctions or differences that I've observed, and this is not something that I've sat down with Parvati and, you know, asked her philosophy about. I've just sort of picked things up from stories, which is kind of how they do it in India anyway, right? But there didn't seem to be a community around Shanathan Baba of many students and disciples who were going through this kind of super rigorous thing. That was something that he put her through. Mm-hmm. Given who she was and when she came to him and sort of all the factors. So I know there are ashrams, there are Bowell Akras and ashrams in Bengal where there's, you know, people live, there's some level of formal structure and community. But I also observe, and fearing the way Parvati speaks about it, that there's also kind of a tremendous sense of, you know, there's a lot of room in a tradition that's been around for at least 600 years in a distinct form, and maybe many, many hundreds of years beyond that. There's a lot of room for different forms of expression, different kinds of, you know, different people doing different things, different. And when you're starting something new and you're a young lineage in the West, and perhaps this is something that the two of you can relate to in your own tradition, you're starting things out from scratch and you're experimenting and you're exploring. So, and I guess the one other thought I would have in response is back to this, you know, something my teacher said, which is, you know, or Mr. Gurdjieff said, every stick has two ends, right? Mm-hmm. So there's anything you do, there's going to be advantages and disadvantages. So one of the disadvantages of having a tradition without any formal hierarchy and structure is that, anybody can come along and claim to be a Bowell and start singing Bowell songs, and that's one of the issues that I know Parvati and many very traditional Bowell practitioners and performers in India are concerned about. Mm. As people who are trying to make a living in India and are musicians, and then they declare themselves Bowells because they know that they'll get an audience for them and so on. So those are some of the drawbacks, but some of the advantages is that sense of room to explore and experiment and not have only one authentic and right way to be Bowell.
Go ahead, Stuart.
Well, I wanted to draw an analogy or ask a question about the tradition as a musical tradition, in the sense that I study shakuhachi with a Japanese teacher.
Right.
And he made a funny comment the other day in a workshop where we were, you know, workshops, people stand around, you know, and he's kind of working on different sound production and different qualities of sound.
Yeah.
And incidentally, we tend to play the same music over and over again. You know, it's like I can really relate to one piece of music a year.
I can testify that's true.
Yeah. But the point I wanted to make is that he made this kind of humorous comment where I was working on something, sort of struggling on something, and finally I kind of got what he wanted me to do, and it was some sort of complex action with my tongue and, you know, breath and attention all at the same time. And he said, see, this is shakuhachi meditation, you know, and silent meditation, you don't know if you did it right or not. But in shakuhachi meditation, you do know. And my point about that is that in a musical tradition, it doesn't matter what someone says.
Yeah. Right.
Everyone knows at some point who's got it and who doesn't.
Yeah.
And you can't hide that because there's a performance element of it that's quite distinct that you don't quite, you know, you can't really tell with a meditation teacher, you know, how deep their meditation mm-hmm. is because mm-hmm. you don't have access to the information and they can say anything they want. But with a musical teacher,
yeah.
For whatever else they do, yeah. you know if they're yeah. good or not.
Yeah, that's right. That's a beautiful, beautiful aspect of that kind of practice.
So I guess I, and that's kind of a way to me of like understanding how hierarchy of competence, or what did Ken call it, hierarchy of, you know, it's like there's hierarchy of power and then there's hierarchy yeah. of kind of capability.
Yes.
And
earned versus
given or conferred.
Yeah, conferred.
And so there's something about that, I think, that speaks to how you can have a flat hierarchy, because it'll be clear mm-hmm. who the real leaders are.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think where it gets tricky in the spiritual domain is that we don't expect our musicians to, have certain kind of ethical codes and standards, and for that matter, to have students who are they're working intimately with in the West, at least, right? So it becomes tricky when all those things become combined, because it's absolutely possible to be an extraordinary performer and somebody who's not ethically compromised, or just not not a safe person to be around, or someone who actually does not embody the spiritual principles that may exist in the songs. And this is a hard lesson that we're learning in the West over and over, right? That mm-hmm. someone can have extraordinary accomplishment in a mystical domain, or in a art or performance domain, or an ability to articulate the teaching, and potentially even in an ability to transmit profound spiritual experiences or catalyze those kinds of experiences, and yet simultaneously be profoundly blind to their own shadow. So it's complex territory, and there's no way around it. I am convinced there is no ticket, there is no shortcut, there is no guarantee of anything. As a practitioner, you're going to have to figure those things out for yourself.
Yeah. I think there is a mitigating factor, which is, even a compromised teacher in that sense has the potential of transmission, and there's the adage that the student makes the teacher, and it's more about, and this kind of reflects some of what Mariana Kaplan talked about in the conscious discipleship. There's more. Mm-hmm. There is a way of being with a teacher,
yes.
and a responsibility one has in working with a teacher, in which you're, in a way, you're the agent of your
yeah.
spiritual process, and that makes that kind of relationship more workable or more robust.
Yes, it does.
Where you have the problem is when someone is like projected on the teacher, or
yeah.
the teacher's fulfilling a psychological function that goes beyond the nature of the teaching, that I think we,
yeah.
where we really start to run into trouble.
Well, I mean, the other thing as a practitioner is that being in the role of a kind of a traditional spiritual teacher with a lot of formal hierarchy around that does not seem to be very good for the practice of that individual in many cases, right? In many cases, it seems that teachers, at least men, who are put in that position or create that position for themselves, end up the structures of formal power that reinforce that position and so on and so forth often end up blinding them in some way that ends up causing a lot of suffering to other people and communities and students, and that it often takes a tremendous shock for them to sort of recognize. At least that's my observation. That's one mm-hmm. of the strong patterns that stood out to me when I was sort of looking at how those things have tended to go in communities here in the West.
Got it. Well, I want to, unless Stuart, you had something. I wanted to sort of broaden the picture here.
Great.
And bring in this word lineage. And I think, I can't remember if you said it during the conversation on air, but certainly before we started the on-air conversation, you located yourself as being a member of, or as being part of a lineage, or feeling no hesitation to locate yourself in that way, and yet you're no longer a part of the Sangha you were part of mm-hmm. for many years, mm-hmm. and it's a very interesting topic to me to sort of tease apart what those distinctions mean. So I don't know where you would start with that, but I invite you to do that, and we can talk more about it.
During this period of reckoning in my community, where a number of folks left and many others stayed, I guess I broadly speaking, saw one of two things happening: as folks were either staying and continuing with the existing structures and sort of views and culture that was there, and really sort of reinforcing that and saying this is what we are going to be true and devotional to and faithful to, and that's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. Or I saw people who I had been practicing with for many years who rejected that, felt critical of that, and they often went sort of back into the secular domain. And one of the lessons that I've learned from my experiences in the past 5 or 6 years is that I can never know what another person's inner life and experience is actually. Mm-hmm. So I have no desire to believe that I can deduce from somebody's external life circumstances what their inner life may be like. Mm-hmm. But I knew that in my case, I couldn't just go back into a entirely secular sphere of life, because the tradition, the Baal tradition, the lineage that I'd been part of, had gotten into my bloodstream, and it was part of me. And so it was just a personal challenge that I was faced with of how do I find a way to keep this connection alive in my own life, with many of my categories sort of blown up, and my affiliations and how I spend my time and who I spend it with, a lot fell away mm-hmm. During my life in that time. So I had to sort of explore and experiment. I've always been a person who maintains long-standing relationships. That's not a particular virtue. It's just that's just my personality. So I've kept open lines of communication with everyone in my life, all the people who are still part of my community, people in previous sanghas that I was part of, like Lee's sangha, and people who've left. To me, I just don't make distinctions in those ways. But the question has been a personal one of how do I keep alive this spirit of this Baal tradition, which made such a deep impression. And I was very fortunate, because many of the people in my community who were faced with a kind of an all-or-nothing choice, mm-hmm. their door to the tradition and the lineage and all of that came through this one community and this one teacher. And without that, it was like they were out. And I know for every one of those people, it was a very painful process to come to terms with leaving. And very lonely and very isolated and all these kinds of things. Just because of the personal circumstances, I had a connection with other sanghas in that same lineage. And I had, again, through the graces of people in that lineage, I had made a connection with Parvati. So just for some very fortuitous personal circumstances that I owe a lot of gratitude for, I was able, during a period of many, many things in my personal life and in my community life just falling apart and falling away to find some new threads and sort of keep a continuity. But I have a lot of empathy for people both, you know, within the lineage that I'm part of and people who've chosen to leave with that sense of sort of an all or nothing choice. I wouldn't wish that to be so for anyone who's devoted their life and their blood, sweat, and tears to spiritual practice.
Okay. That all makes sense and it's very clear. I'm not sure that I entirely agree with that it could only be an absence of virtue on your part. Not that I mean that you... In other words, it's like to maintain open lines of communication across gulfs such as you describe, and you're saying it's due to no virtue on your part. I'm not sure I can believe that entirely. Not because I think you're virtuous, but because it's a thing that people can do or not do, and some people are. I'll grant you that, you know, people have strengths and weaknesses in different areas, and you may have a particular strength so that it's not as hard for you, and it might be harder for others.
What I meant to say is very simply that just by personality type, I have a hard time letting go. So
that's a little different.
Yeah, so it's sort of, that's just how I'm thrown to be, so
okay.
to speak, right? That's just
okay.
Like, that's just kind of what I do.
Okay.
And I have some values around it as well.
And maybe that's part of the virtue.
Yeah.
So that's a parenthetical comment, but I'm still. And what you said was very articulate, but I still don't hear a question about lineage. What does lineage mean?
Mm-hmm.
Answered. And I'd like to hear more about that, especially because of what you've just told us about how difficult this can be.
Okay, great. So, I think, you know, in the communities that I've been part of, and I think in many spiritual communities, because I found this in many different traditions, what lineage means is something very specific and somewhat concrete. It means that you have a formal student-teacher relationship with someone who had a formal student-teacher relationship with someone, mm-hmm. and you can trace that back quite a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some reason to believe that the people in that lineage are not just whack jobs who declared themselves something or other and then, you know, got a bunch of... But there's some credibility to that, right? Mm-hmm. There's some sense of... And that is intended to function partly as a counterbalance to the inherent dangers and risks of spiritual community and hierarchy and so on, right?
In much the same way that you related that... Parvati's husband, I believe, told you that you have to take the long view and there are ups and downs.
Well, but more specifically, it's a check and balance mechanism in a traditional lineage not just anybody can declare themselves to be a spiritual teacher.
Oh, okay. Sure.
And if they do, you should be very skeptical and cautious, right?
Okay.
So that's kind of what lineage means in the sort of most literal and simple kind of a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, you might say that there are spiritual traditions that have a kind of a lineage to them, right? So there's a particular lineage within the Baal tradition of Parvati Baal and her guru Shanatan Das and then his guru and so on and so forth. But then there's also in the Baal tradition as a whole can be a lineage of a certain kind, mm-hmm. right? And then there's and all of this revolves around the question of transmission, of something being passed on from one to the next and generation to generation.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the sense of lineage in the sense of a purely inward experience, the authenticity of which is not subject to external validation.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I have a friend who's trained for many years at the Grotowski Work Center in Italy, which is a very fascinating spiritual, I would call a spiritual tradition of performance that drew inspiration from the Baha'is, but was kind of goes back to Jerzy Grotowski, who was a brilliant, innovative theater director with a profound spiritual orientation. And this friend, who lives in Birmingham, Alabama, considers Walt Whitman to be one of his spiritual grandfathers. And he has a photograph of Walt Whitman in this art space that he has in Birmingham there. And that's because of some profound connection that he experienced and some transmission that he received from Walt Whitman's work. And I feel much the same about you know, individual artists, musicians, writers, performers, and so on. So there's no one who can come and say to you, Rob, you know, your sense of profound communion that you experience with this classical composer and the profound depth that which you feel that individual's work has imprinted on you and made an impact on your spiritual development to such a degree that you at times, you know, feel a sense of communion with the spirit of that composer, right? Mm-hmm. No one else can judge that. So there's also a sense of transmission that occurs spontaneously in that way. And one of the interesting things that emerged for me in my own personal process of wrestling as things fell away and I had to reinvent was the recognition that I had formerly been a recognized spiritual student of two different teachers in this Western ball lineage at different points. But the heart experience of what the guru actually is, in my particular case, didn't come in those two formal student-teacher relationships, one of which lasted for many years, 15 years. Mm-hmm. But it did come with that homeless African-American, Native American musician. In a moment, sitting in his apartment, I've experienced it in a couple of other cases in relationships with people who were not spiritual teachers, but they weren't, literally. I mean, but what I experienced in them was something that caused me to ask the question, what is the guru? What is the spiritual teacher, actually? What is the real essence of that? And the conclusion I came to personally was that what's the guru is when you experience two things in another human being or in relationship to another human being. One is the sense of absolutely causeless love and devotion, where you just adore and love this other human, and you don't really care about their personality, what they do, who they, it's just an irrational, devotional love. And the second thing is that you experience through your interaction with this person a kind of growth in your inner life that is extraordinary and remarkable. And when those two things come together, that's the presence of the guru. And I'm glad we got onto this because I wanted to bring this up. There's an incredible film that I highly recommend anyone listening to this program listen to. I don't know if the two of you have happened to see it. It's a documentary film called Kumare.
I've heard of it. I haven't watched it.
So it's a documentary about an Indian guy. So he's American. I believe he's born in this country. His parents come from India. Mm-hmm. He looks very Indian, but he's the impression that I got from seeing the film so a few years back was that he was a very secular, modern American guy. And he starts out wanting to make a documentary about some yoga teachers, and the particular teachers that he has in mind, and he's got an agreement with it, somehow all falls through, and yet he's got this budget, and he's got everything all set up. So he decides to do this different sort of radical experiment. And he poses as a guru, and he makes a documentary about his experiences posing to be an Indian guru. And he goes to India.
I have heard of this film, but I haven't seen it.
He does like, I don't know, a month long at yoga intensive or something. And according to my impression, it was some years back that I saw it, but my memory is that he really was like, he didn't really know much about this stuff. You know, he'd grown up, so it was part of his heritage, but he wasn't immersed in it at all. Like, he literally went and did a crash course in yoga. Then he comes back and he's grown his his hair out, and he's got now this beard, and he's picked up some yogic terminology, and he has a very good Indian accent, and he declares himself to be a guru, and he gathers these students around him, and the documentary charts the course of maybe a year or something of which this whole thing is going on. And there are many interesting aspects of the film. And there are moments that are hilarious, there are moments that are disturbing and concerning, but there are some very touching moments. And some of the touching moments are moments when something that I would describe as an authentic spiritual transmission occurs. And so there's moments where you see him in character with this accent, you know, playing this role, and someone has a very profound opening or moment of insight, which they attribute to him in their great. And then sort of he'll, like, you know, the next shot will be him turning to the camera and going, oh, God, what have I done? I don't know what I'm doing. And there's one point where he resolves that he's going to come clean. He's going to say, folks, I got to explain this to you. I'm not who I've been pretending to be. But he can't do it. Like, the moment is there and the camera's on, and you see all this devotion from his students, and he can't bring himself to do it. But the interesting part that's relevant to the point we were just speaking about is that there's some authentic transmission that occurs. Something actually. And so when I saw that, I was like, why? What's going on there? How did that occur? So part of my conclusion was, as all the ancient teachings tell us, and modern depth psychology as well, we all have access to these transpersonal, profound, beyond the individual human personality, spiritual dimensions to our being and to our psyche. And so it really is not that ultimately that the pure spiritual enlightenment exists and that person over there, and because of that, they are able to do something to you and like that. That's not actually how it works. Lee Lozowick, who was one of my teachers in the Western Bal tradition, used to say, without the student, there is no teacher. Right? So it really is a relationship. And it's in that dialogic relationship that the guru manifests, that transmission occurs. Mm-hmm. So those were some of the conclusions that I came to about the nature of the guru, and that the guru is actually invoked in relationship between two human beings. That was where I got to.
Thank you. That was extremely articulate and welcome.
So we are getting close to the end of our time. Maybe we should fast forward to. So what are you doing now? What projects do you have going on now? And, you know, how do people find out about your work?
So there's, I guess, two primary projects that I'm involved in now. One is that I am working with a group of folks who bring Parvati Bowl to the U.S. and to the Bay Area every year and other places to perform and teach.
You come out to this area too, right?
Yeah, and there's a group here. We did a retreat with her and some other assistant teachers helping. We did a weekend retreat in Sebastopol area just in August. So there may be another of those coming in 2019.
Yeah, I just want to, just as an aside, if there's any way that Many Rivers can support that, we have good
outreach.
Yeah, that would be lovely. That would be lovely. I've been sort of hoping that we would cross paths in that way. So there's a group of us that work with Parvati and host her and organize events and so on and so forth. So that's one project. Certainly if anybody is interested or involved, they can contact me. And there's a nonprofit organization here led by someone in the Bay Area that helps organize events and accepts donations, tax deductible donations. Parvati is in the process of construction on an ashram, near Shantiniketan in West Bengal, India. And that ashram is a task that she was given by her guru, Shanatan, and she'll be instructing students, working with young people to train them in the Bal arts, and also archiving the tradition, and there are many other wonderful aspects of that project that you can find out about on a website, which is saksouthasia.com, S-A-C sothasia.com. So that's
and we'll put that on our podcast posting for this show.
Great. So that's one project, and there's just lovely, lovely community of folks, a network of people that are collaborating on that together from all different kinds of backgrounds, longtime yoga practitioners and devotees, and totally secular folks who just like what we're doing. So that's one project, and then my business is a project of sorts. I do strategic planning and leadership training and development. And I work with organizations all across the country, primarily national parks. But I also have worked with private companies and nonprofits in the Bay Area. So that's that company was founded by one of my teachers. So it's the principles that we work from are a blend of traditional sort of spiritual principles and sort of the best thinking about leadership and from the contemporary Western scientific perspective. So that work is happening. And then the third thing is that my partner, Macy Chadwick, is an artist and a bookmaker and a teacher of art for many, many years. And she's just founding an artist residency in Petaluma, where three artists at a time will come from anywhere from 1 week to a month and be in residence and make art. The residency has a special focus on printmaking and book arts, which is the artistic discipline of creating an entire book, which is handmade and a work of art, and also on writing. So there's a writing studio for writers to come and do retreats, and that's right here in Petaluma. It will be welcoming its first residents on January 7th. And as that gets up and going, we'll have monthly open house events and art shows and other kinds of public events, and would love to get to know folks in Petaluma and Sebastopol area that have an interest in the arts.
Fabulous. Thank you.
Well, excellent. Well, we really appreciate you coming on the show. I've known you've been out in this area for a while, so it was a good excuse to reconnect.
Yeah, it's been lovely. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
I really liked where we got to with this conversation. Yeah. Thanks.
You have been listening to The Mystical Positivist. I'm your host, Stuart Goodnick. This week on the show, we've been speaking in the studio with Joshua Levitt. Joshua Levitt has pursued spiritual practice intensively since the late 1980s, including extensive stays in Israel and India, living for 5 years on an ashram in the U.S., and working closely with spiritual teachers from the Baal tradition, which originated in Bengal, India.
Next week's Mystical Positivist show will feature a pre-recorded conversation with Tibetan teacher Anab Tubten and an in-studio conversation with Laura Duggan, focusing on Anab Tubten's latest book, The Fragrance of Emptiness, a commentary on the Heart Sutra. Anab Tubten grew up in Tibet and at an early age began to practice in the Nyingma tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. He's the founder and spiritual advisor of Dharmata Foundation, teaching widely in the U.S. and abroad. He's also the author of various articles and books in both the Tibetan and English languages. His books in English include No Self, No Problem, The Magic of Awareness, and Embracing Each Moment, A Guide to the Awakened Life. Laura Duggan has been a student and practitioner of Vedanta, Kashmir Shaivism, and currently Tibetan Buddhism for the past 38 years. She actively engages in self-inquiry and meditation on a daily basis and loves to discuss the application of philosophy to daily life. She currently is the volunteer retreat coordinator for meditation retreats with Anab Tubten in the Bay Area. She's the editor of the book Fragrance of Emptiness. Tune in for that show on Saturday, December 15th from 4 to 6 p.m.
Coming up on the spiritual calendar in Sonoma County, Follow Your Dread to the Mystical Heart with the Taya Meditation Center staff, meeting Wednesday at 7:30 p.m., December 12th, at Mini Rivers Books and Tea at 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. Story has it that in the very bottom fissure of hell, the deepest recess glowing with unquenchable fires, a simple drain cover lies unnoticed. Find and remove the cover, descend through the narrow drain, and emerge into the highest, most radiant realm of heaven. If this metaphor resonates with something in you, our practice group work that focuses upon Follow Your Dread may resonate still more deeply. No one can be divorced from or denied access to the mystical heart. but to open and then live within the mystical heart of the world and ourselves has a cost. We don't get there by denying, sweeping under the rug, or putting aside the aspects that we dislike of who we have been. The mystical heart receives the light and the dark without judgment. So in our group and individual practice, we seek to cultivate a heart mind that holds all contents of consciousness simultaneously with discernment and without discrimination. Following your dread is an undertaking best accomplished in the company of fellow travelers and with guidance from others who have gone before. Join us Wednesdays at 7:30 at Many Rivers in downtown Sebastopol to learn more about the realistic path to the mystical heart.
This coming week's Thursday at Many Rivers event in Sebastopol is a concert, The Night Mists Came Rising, with Dominic Shaner, lutenist, guitarist, composer, musicologist. That's this Thursday, December 13th at 7:30 p.m. at Many Rivers Books in D-130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. Music by Jakob Bro, born 1978, Stefan Grossman, born 1945, Arvo Pärt, born 1935, and Dominic Shaner, born 1985. Exploring the tombo, which is tomb, and tintinnabulum, or bell, compositional forms for guitars in various tunings and loops. Lutenist, musicologist, and composer Dominic Shaner grew up on a small family farm in rural California. Here in this infinite expanse of nature, he was introduced to music at a young age. During his following musical life, Dominic has given concerts as both solo and ensemble musician throughout North America and in Europe. Dominic lives in West Sonoma County, where he curates radio shows for KOWS.FM 92.5. He collects private press records and forages for mushrooms around his home in the forest. An advocate for those forgotten and silenced by society, Dominic directs orchestras and explores restorative practices with at-risk populations.
Thank you for joining us once again for the Mystical Positivist. Podcasts of all our shows can be found at www.mysticalpositivist.blogspot.com, as well as commentary and discussion of topics of interest to the show. Also, please send comments and feedback to mysticalpositivist@gmail.com and join us again next Saturday.
We leave you with a piece whose name I will probably murder. Pare loye jau ame, take me across, live. Say it right for it.
I'm not going to do a lot better than you.
Okay, that's from the companion CD to the book The Bowel Tradition, Sahaj Vision, East and West. The piece is performed by Parvati Bowel. Enjoy.
Thank you.